From Paul's house and Storm's house, it's Paul and Storm talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes, on average.
Hot pie!
Winter is coming. I'm Paul.
I'm Storm.
And we're going to talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes.
On average. Tonight, it's Tuesday, February, we'll call it the 2nd, 2011.
And this is show 105. Hello, it's... Storm.
Hi, Paul. How are you this evening?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
So, this happened just off air, but I guess you missed seeing Weird Al Yankovic by just a little bit. Is that
well,
right?
No, we saw him. He was his brand new kids book is
yeah.
out, and as it turns out, was debuting a short drive from my house at a Barnes & Noble in New Jersey. He was doing his very first signing there.
Oh, so that was actually like the official unveiling?
Yeah, the very first, his first signing, certainly. I mean, yeah. it was out everywhere today, but this is his first appearance with it, other than, of course, all the press he did earlier today, like on the Today Show and God knows what else.
Isn't that funny that stuff still comes out on Tuesday?
Like, I know, it's just the way it is.
I guess if something has been working, why change it?
That's right. But anyway, we had, because we're all like close personal friends and buddies with Weird Al Yankovic now.
Is our close personal friend, Mr. Yeah. Al Yankovic?
No, but I contacted him and had said, hey, you're coming like right near my house and we should, you know, arrange to say hello. Not like a dinner or anything, because he had a busy day, but we were hoping he was scheduled to show up early and do a meet and greet with the staff. And he was going to try and sneak us back then, you know, say hi to the family and such. And as it turned out, he got there late because it's wintry weather up here in the Northeast, and went straight to the book signing because there was hundreds of people there waiting to sign.
Yeah.
And we half considered sticking around till the end, but we realized he had several hours worth of signing ahead of him, and we all ran out of steam and just dejectedly left to the strains of Vince Guaraldi's Christmas Time Is Here.
Huh. See, I think if there's anyone that could get away with having like a Rube Goldberg signing machine so that he wouldn't actually have to do any of the writing, it would be Al Yankovic. Like, yeah, Weird Al could have that. That would be acceptable.
Him or Adam and Jamie on the Mythbusters. They could both get away with that.
I think there's an assignment there for Adam and Jamie to develop a mechanical signing pen for Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah, get on that shit, Mythbusters. Actually, I guess Grant would be really the guy for it. He would build a robot who would sign his signature.
That's true.
As opposed to a Rube Goldbergian contraption.
Yeah, no, Grant would get right to the important part of it. So the actual signing, the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, to the one bit of business that we have at the top of the show.
Yes.
The Paul and Storm Brigade of Minions, 390.
Good
fun
Lord.
Loving minion. I know. And we're so close to naming a penultimate minion. That's minion number 399, I guess, is what we decided was the penultimate minion. Before we go to a new designation, go to paulandstorm.com to find out about that exciting program. And a couple of people pointed out the cruise, the Joko cruise crazy, would have been the perfect opportunity to activate the brigade because there were a number of brigadiers.
It's true. That's a good point. Well, you know, we don't want to waste it. It's got to be really good when we really activate them for something.
Well, we did
physical.
We did. They were responsible for starting the protests in Egypt. So,
well, of course, there's that. But we didn't really want to take credit for that.
No, and we haven't. We still haven't. It's just a joke. Just a joke, people.
Ha ha ha! Just kidding.
Ha 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 ha. So I got some stuff written down. Nothing of great import. We have
sure.
We have the things we've been doing. We can talk about. But why don't we just talk about some stuff?
Okay. I have a I have a question that needs well, it doesn't need judging, but okay. I'm interested in hearing people's responses.
All right. I'm intrigued.
Yeah. Okay. So here I posit the following. I don't posit the following. My words aren't coming to me very well tonight, so I'll just say, I will say this. I will describe the situation, and you tell me what you think, and then the people can tell me what they think.
I was discussing this with
my wife and her friend a couple of weeks ago.
All right.
Let's see. In high school, there was one teacher at my high school. Her name was Frida Hollihan.
Mm-hmm.
And she taught European history and honors European history.
Yes.
And honors European history was unofficially known as the GPA buster.
Yes.
Basically, all the super smart kids with the 4.0s, mm-hmm. their GPAs would dash against the rocks of honors European history. But they were like drawn. They had to take it because when you're an overachieving high school student like that, you have to take all the advanced classes to show everyone how awesome you are. And well,
like a moth to the flame.
Exactly,
you cannot resist it.
Exactly. Or like a sailor to the sirens.
Yes. And sailors love sirens. That's alternative rock band from 1999.
Yes, totally. But you know, so she just, she destroyed more, perfect little GPA dreams in our high school than just about anyone else. And she was actually, in retrospect, you know, back then she was this old scary lady that everyone hated because she was unpleasant. And, you know, you look back on it and you realize she was just the only person teaching what was essentially a college level course.
Right. And was brought in to do that and not to be sugar footy kind of person, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, she didn't have to do that, but that was her choice, and that was fine. Now, I was the kind of person who always did really well in school, and I would always skate by with the minimal amount of effort required in order to do well.
That's horrible, Paul. I can't imagine anyone behaving that way.
I know. But it was what I was born with, and informs my shitty work ethic to this day.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I was also not an idiot.
Right.
And I didn't give a crap about being valedictorian.
Sure.
Or having a perfect 4.0 or anything like that. Or having the greatest possible transcript. So I said, screw that. I'm taking regular European history.
Yeah.
Which I proceeded to do with all of the various other regular kids. Now, even the regular European history course was relatively difficult. It's a lot of memorizing of names and dates.
Right. King this and date
King this and
that.
Prince that and war of this from date X to date Y.
Right. And drawing maps of France.
Exactly. It was nothing but drawing maps of France.
That's what you do in European history. But sometimes it's Gaul. You have to watch out for when it's Gaul.
Oh, God. Don't get me started on when it's Gaul. So it was, you know, it was not an easy class, even at the regular level.
Yep.
Nah, and she would give regular exams, like not just little quizzes, but, you know, full on exams for this course, certainly more than you're used to in high school. And the second exam in, or, you know, just after the second exam, a friend of mine in my class comes to me and says, hey, my older brother took this class, and what Frida Hollihan would do, you know, she would, you know, you'd take your test, she would grade it, and then hand it back to you.
Yeah.
And you were allowed to keep it and take it home and do whatever you want with it.
Sure.
Most people would, you know, tear them in frustration or burn them after having made an effigy of Frida Hollihan or whatever.
Yep. Or make exam latkes, just depending on the season.
Yes. Now, the reason my friend mentioned this fact is because it turned out that Frida Hollihan never changed her exams. The exams her older brother was 2 or 3 years older than us.
Yep.
And as it turned out, every single test she gave was the same as the one she gave 3 years prior.
Guess she wasn't all that, was she?
I guess she was, well, she was old, she was cranky, she was probably feeling a little lazy at this point.
And the internet didn't exist at that point.
Yeah, there was no internet, certainly to speak of as far as we were concerned.
Right.
This is 1986, 87.
Right. DARPA's had the internet since 1901, but yeah, as far as the rest of us.
There was no internet outside of the Pentagon and the Department of Commerce or whatever it connected to.
Sorry, I just have an image of this pipe coming out of the Pentagon, and and right below it is this pipe for soup.
the internet
Pentagon
was originally
soup pipe.
The internet was originally designed to transport soup.
Yes, like the internet itself was a byproduct of the process of getting soup to the Pentagon.
Yeah, it was originally, yeah, just it did all the hefty calculations as far as figuring out how to most efficiently get soup from the Pentagon to other places in Washington, losing the least amount of heat and chunks of potato.
Potato, yes. But of course, it was a mechanical internet at the time because they didn't have computers per se.
Steampunk internet.
Steampunk soup internet.
there's our front runner for our
But I'm sorry, I've sillied up your recollection.
Yes, but we digress.
After you've posited.
Yes. Wow, we're doing all kinds of things tonight. So we proceed to this friend, myself, and two other people that we knew.
Yep.
Would, look at copies of this exam prior, each exam prior to the one coming up. And then would proceed to do awesome on every test from then on in. We would intentionally get one or two wrong, so we never got hundreds. We always got 98s and 97s and 95s.
Now, did you coordinate to make sure that you didn't each get the same question wrong?
No, I don't think we were quite that in depth.
Okay.
That's as it was. We all did well. All of us got A's in the class. She was none the wiser. Blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm. Till now.
Well, now here is the question.
Yes.
Actually, it's a multi-part question.
All right.
A, was what we did cheating? B, was what we did ethical? And C, was what we did fair? I have maintained since that time that it was not cheating. I like to think I have a pretty solid moral sense as far as these things. Like, for example, when I play golf, even when golfing alone, I don't take a mulligan. I was always taught to play the ball where it lies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say I never cheated on exams.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly didn't do it regularly.
Yep.
Things like in college when I was taking Russian in that third semester where I really didn't give a crap about Russian, I took a little piece of paper to help me with a couple of verb forms or something.
Right.
It was certainly not in a class that was going to matter, so to speak. I certainly was not what by any stretch you would call a regular cheater. I think I probably cheated as much as or less than the average student.
Right. So you were not a habitual cheater. You were not a cheatscape.
Exactly. I would never go into any exam thinking, how can I cheat? For example, if she had, say, put each exam in her drawer and we had stolen into her classroom when she wasn't there and taken these exams out and photocopied them and put them back, that I would entirely consider cheating.
Okay. So
if her brother had taken the exams without her knowing it, if she was supposed to collect them and she wasn't supposed to give them to you at the end of the year,
right?
But he managed to hang on to them.
You're already defending yourself here.
Well,
so.
I'm getting to that, but like I would not consider that. I mean, I would consider that cheating as well. Like if he had come by his exams in any nefarious manner, and or if we had come by them in any nefarious manner, I would say that is cheating. My wife and her friend both seemed to think that we were cheating.
Mm-hmm.
They never really gave a really proper answer as to why they thought it was cheating, which is why I don't think we ever really finished the conversation. But I think they probably didn't really think it was cheating so much as they thought it was unfair,
right,
or unethical. But let's tackle the first one first. See what you think, Storm.
Well, I'm not gonna.
Do you think that I cheated?
I'm gonna take them out of order. I'm taking them out of order because that's how I'm going.
Okay.
I'm going to say it was certainly unethical. because, and that's not to say that I haven't done similar things. Mm-hmm. So I'm certainly not judging you as a person. So right. Get that there, right out there at the front.
Right.
I would say it is unethical because you knew that you were getting an advantage that other people would not have. So you use this information for your personal advantage. So,
okay, well, let me counter back at you at saying that these things, you know, these exams aren't zero sum games. It wasn't necessarily giving me an advantage over other people.
Well, just in terms of, it's not even versus other people, in terms of the grade that you deserved to get. So I would say it's unethical because it if without that piece of paper, your grade probably would not have been as high. So in that regard, having access to that information and using it stains that grade. So that's where I would call it unethical.
Okay, I would say it's certainly more of a gray area ethically, as far as I'm concerned. But I still don't know that it's entirely unethical. Let me ask you this. Let me, if it's a question of degrees, which I think it is, if I had a friend who had taken this same course the previous semester and took really good notes.
Yep.
And I said, could I borrow your notes to study off of because you're an awesome note taker?
Yep.
And they said, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that. Would you consider that unethical?
No, the reason is because that person did not know precisely, and if I understand your story correctly, you knew precisely what the questions would be. So, and again, it's not in relation to other people, but in terms of the whole idea behind a test is, at least before the internet, is there are all these topics, you don't know which ones, so you have to study them all.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what the questions are, there's no motivation and incentive to learn the other things. Like, it's not supposed to be a comprehensive, these are the things that you know, should know about European history. Maybe it is, don't know. But for that reason, just studying the notes is basically having another go at watching the lectures, you know, which is not unethical because it doesn't give you a key to the exam like actually having those specific questions.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, even if you had the questions, it depends. If you had the questions and the correct answers, it's certainly much more towards the black in terms of ethics versus even just having the questions. If you only had the questions, I'd say it's slightly less unethical, but still unethical because you'd still have to do the work to study those specific questions, but mm-hmm. you didn't have to allocate resources towards the zillion, billion, kajillion other France map drawing related questions.
Right.
So that's where I am on ethical.
I still sort of find that more on the fairness end of things than I will say this. Like, I think what we did was entirely unfair insofar as we didn't share it with the rest of the class.
So I don't see any unfair being a thing. Like, it's just sort of a what are you saying? What is fairness here? What's fairness?
Fairness was at least in comparison to the other people in the class, we had access to these exams that other people did not, even though we did not come across them in any illegal, quote unquote, way.
Though you already disqualified fair by saying that you're not, it wasn't graded on a curve. You're not in graded in comparison. So fair doesn't matter.
I'm just saying, like, you know, let's say you and I were in a class together.
Yep.
And we go through the entire semester, you know, say you were in this European history class with me and we go through the entire semester. And at the end of that semester, only then do I tell you, by the way, Storm, I had all of these exams, you know, the situation exactly as it was, but I did not share them with you. And then I told you at the end of the semester, you'd be pretty pissed at me, and I would bet you'd use words along the lines of, oh man, that's so not fair.
In those terms, sure, but when I think fair, I would say if you and I were both in competition to be valedictorian,
right,
and you withheld it until afterwards, then it's not fair. If it's just a question of you did better in the class than your friend, and there's nothing at stake, and there's no competition other than bragging rights, mm-hmm. and that you had, you know, you were betting a pack of bubble yum on who got a better grade in the class, then it's unfair. Otherwise, it's just, oh man, you know, you're a lousy friend. You know, that's sort of what it comes down to. So fair isn't a thing.
Mm-hmm.
The grayer area for me is the question of, is it cheating?
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, I would almost take this legalistically and say, because there was never was it said that you could not get this there.
That is correct. She never said, you know, don't show these exams to anyone else.
Right.
And as described before, it's not like we stole the exams from a locked cabinet, and I'm going to give you
a pass on that one, because for me, it's more like, not to swell you up here, but kind of like Captain Kirk in the Kobayashi Maru scenario.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You found a third path. Now, because you found it first, or you and your friend did, it's sort of like, okay, you should be rewarded for your initiative, you know, and that it's not a habit that you didn't go about looking for these ways to cheat exams all the time. This one happens to come along and you said, aha, and you did put the work in in order to get the grade that you did, and even sandbagging a little, though I would still not give you the pass on ethical. So no, you didn't cheat, but it was marginally unethical.
Fair doesn't matter. I'm pretty much with you there. In that I firmly believe I did not cheat. I certainly broke no rules.
I'm agreeing with you on that.
And I think it was a gray area. It was certainly not cleanly ethical. I think I disagree with you as far as how unethical it was.
I don't think it's like a black stain on your soul unethical.
Well, no, but yeah.
But clearly on the unethical side, I'll say that.
And fairness, you're abstaining since it wasn't in a matter of,
there's no question of fairness here.
Yeah. I think I'm thinking of fairness more just in the friend getting pissed at another friend, description of fairness, like the junior high schoolers or elementary schoolers description of what is fair and what is not fair.
What do they know, though?
That's true.
What did we know what fair was? Honestly,
but all of that said, I will be interested in hearing what the people out there have to say regarding those three questions.
Yeah, I want to hear what you have to say about this
and,
too.
I promise not to jump down the throats of anyone who believes that I was cheating, but I would like to hear a cogent argument as to why it would be cheating.
In fact, I would love to see the poll. Did Paul cheat on his test? Of course, a lot of people are just going to see the poll, not having seen the podcast, and be like, yeah, he's a goofball. He cheats on tests all the time.
Yeah.
Or whatever they say. And they say it like that. We know that you don't say it like that, but some people say it like that.
Somebody, Barney Fife, says it like that.
Yeah, he does. In fact, in several episodes, there were exams. Well, good. I feel like we added to intelligent discourse with that.
Yeah, that's right. We pulled a little Socratic method. Not really Socratic method. A little Socratic dialogue happening there.
Oh, sure. We slathered some Socratic method all over that sandwich.
Oh, this thing's just covered in frickin' Socrates now.
Socrates. Ooh, covered in Socrates.
Covered in Socratesic secretions. So would those be Socratesians?
Sure.
No, they would not.
I'm going to the Twitters for a question that's kind of interesting, a little lighter in nature. Nothing about ethics, at least not that I can think of. Fogan has asked, how spicy is too spicy?
Good question. Is it Fogan or P. Hogan?
Is it P. Hogan?
I don't know.
I don't know. I know we've taken questions from him before. So
yes.
I like Fogan either
way. It's Fogan.
It's Fogan.
We've decreed.
It's probably Paul Hogan. Will be corrected soon. Probably as soon as he hears this.
Yeah.
I would say it's relative, but one answer I would have that would cover everyone would be too spicy is the point at which the heat, and I assume you mean like Tabasco sauce spicy, habanero spicy.
Or like curry or
something like
something on the Scoville scale.
Exactly. The point at which you are no longer enjoying your food, that it is just beating back that sensation.
The point at which heat overwhelms flavor.
Correct. Assuming that you don't enjoy that sensation. Like some people I have read get an endorphin rush from that extreme spiciness.
Oops.
Like I happen to enjoy very spicy foods.
As do
And over time, like there's a lipid that you can develop. And you know how when you're a kid, you were much more sensitive to spicy foods. Your body, or at least I was, and over time, your body can develop more of these, not sensors, but the ability to coat your taste buds with this lipid.
Your taste bud muscles get stronger.
Basically, but it's like a screen protector for your iPhone or for your Droid or for
your tongue
thingy. But it's for your tongue, exactly. It's a screen protector for your tongue that your body produces at no extra charge. So that's what I think.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I have nothing more to add. Let's go to something else.
Oh, sure. I was going to tell a stupid young Storm story.
Let's tell a stupid young Storm story.
And probably the very moment that I realized it was Chinese food. You know, I have those little red peppers.
Yes.
I decided to show off and eat one day while we were at the Chinese restaurant. And it was fine. I guess because it was, you know, there are dud peppers now and then. And on a subsequent visit, I did it again, thinking, I've got this. I've got this in the bag.
Yep.
And my 7-year-old head just like exploded into a beet red headness of pain. So
it's another front runner for this title of this podcast.
So never again.
Never again.
Now, I already know that we have, on behalf of both of us, a very big Paul and Storm recommends for you.
Yes, you go ahead.
This is something, I actually think it was Jonathan Colton that turned us on to it.
He was the specific pusher, although I think John Hodgman was the original, like he was the one who pushed Colton into it and was praising it on the Twitters.
It's all things flowing down from Hodgman.
Yes, it's Hodgman's all the way down.
And it has been out there as well, and of course is now going to be an HBO series of some kind. But A Game of Thrones, the Song of Ice and Fire series.
Fire and Ice. Technically, it's Fire and Ice.
Well, whatever. All right. I'm going to say whatever, because I said A Game of Thrones, and that's the first book. And if you open up the book cover, it has all the information for you. I'm going to get beaten down for that, but I don't care. And I'm sure half of you are nodding your heads, and you're like, yeah, of course. What took you so long? It's only been, the series has been in process for 80 years, so what took you so long? But it's just such this deep, rich fantasy world, and like I used to read a lot of fantasy when I was a kid and a teenager, but then really left it because so much of it just sort of seemed like someone was just writing down their D&D adventures, you know, which is fine for when you're playing D&D. It's fun, but to make a book out of that, it's sort of like, okay, you know, you're just sort of pulling stuff out of your ass here. Yeah. Although, of course, the better stuff, and I'm going to get beaten down for this too. Of course, there's a lot of fantasy fiction since I left it that's been written, I'm sure, that does have a lot of integrity to it and depth. But this series has it just out the wing yang bong chong. That's how out there it has it.
It has a wing yang bong chong that is over full.
Yeah, but just like the things that you expect will happen don't always happen.
Yep.
But in ways that aren't sort of a ah-ha-ha or a pull-it-out-of-your-ass type of thing.
Yeah. The ads for the HBO version have been describing it as The Sopranos meets Lord of the Rings, which is certainly an oversimplification, but it is, you know, sort of the medieval-ish setting of Lord of the Rings with the machinations and intrigue.
Family intrigue
of a Sopranos. Although I personally like to think of it a little bit more like, in its own way, like The Wire.
Yeah.
In a swords and sorcery setting. And to its credit, as you have said in our private conversations, the magic stuff, at least so far, has been kept to a relative minimum, which is, I do not read much fantasy at all. Never really did. Just because I sort of, as with you, I kind of lose it when the magic comes around, because then, hey, look, I'm inventing all of my own rules as I go along.
I'm ahead of you by not quite a whole book at this point. I'm on the third book.
Yep.
And it gets more magic-y, but it has enough integrity to it that you can see it's all tied together, and it's not just, I want to have a character that shoots violet spaghetti out of his eyes, because that would be cool. It's not like that.
Really awesome.
that would be kind of awesome. Podcast over, I'm gonna write a story about that right now.
That's not a particularly useful trick.
Well, in a land,
man would a kill at parties.
Yeah. Well, in a land where spaghetti can disintegrate mountains. imagine. Didn't think of that, did you?
Only spaghetti of the right of the proper hue can destroy this mountain.
Yes, ultra pink spaghetti of the Quartharf Kong. Anyway, it's not like that at all. And there's a character named Hot Pie, so...
Yeah. What's not to love about it?
Yeah, no, it is terrific. And there are four books that are out, and I guess it's been 4 or 5 years since... It's supposed to be at least... I guess if you go to Wikipedia, it says there are going to be 7 books eventually. Mm-hmm. And it's been like 4 or 5 years since he's written the last one. And stop bugging him about it, apparently.
This is George R.R. Martin is the author, by the way.
Which he must have known when he was born, or at least once he was old enough to know what letters were that he was destined to write fantasy of some sort with those two middle initials.
He was also destined to become a punchline in a Paul and Storm song about pirates.
Yes, indeed. He has.
Yeah.
Well, one other short thing. We're actually been grooving along here.
Yeah.
Check out. This is really exciting to me. The Geek a Week card series our good friend Len Peralta, Jawbone Radio, has been doing this past week. It featured us, and it's awesome. We are Zephod Beeblebrox. Of the Hitchhiker's Guide series, and Len did an awesome job of rendering that. Very pleased with the Pan Galactic Gargle Blaster that he envisioned,
and a lovely green towel across our shoulder.
And my jazz was already spunky, like just seeing the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that just made the head spin around and explode was that Len did manage to get Neil Gaiman to write the card back.
You mean our close personal friend Neil Gaiman, the
our
author,
close
and
personal friend,
screenwriter, and raconteur and chef.
The same. Try his beer can chicken. But yes, and he nailed it. So check that out if you go to Geek a Week. I think geekaweek.net, but look up Geek a Week and you'll find it. There's some other site that actually has geekaweek.com.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to do one more quick Paul and Storm recommends, and then I'm going to do a battle that someone has suggested on the Twitters.
I didn't see
that. My other recommends, comedian Mark Maron does a podcast called the WTF podcast, also known as the What the Fuck podcast. If you are a person... If you are particularly enjoys comedy and people talking about comedy, both in a anecdotal, here's some hilarious stories from the roadway, and also just sort of a comedy theory. Like if you're a comedy nerd, this is a really good podcast for you. Mark is a very funny comedian. He's also, sort of the stereotypical troubled, self-involved, dude that's in therapy and loves to hear himself talk. He's very he's very self-aware about that. I'm not sort of denigrating him about that. That's just that's sort of his style. He's a talker. But almost despite himself and in many cases because of it, he is an excellent interviewer. He knows pretty much everybody in comedy and has had many/most of them on the show and had some very interesting discussions. I would especially recommend he did a two-parter with Louis C.K. That was very funny and incredibly interesting, especially if you like Louis C.K. But go check it out. It's an excellent podcast. Says I, and many.
So say we all.
So that said, let us go to our final battle suggestion, and this is from Sasquatch2101.
I like it already.
Suggests the following battle: Captain Kirk versus Han Solo.
Yeah,
the battleground is a bake-off.
Captain Kirk versus Han Solo. Bake off, as in baked goods, not any other type of cooking.
I would say bake off. Yeah, let's say the Pillsbury Bake Off.
Okay, because that's very different from cooking. Because
yeah,
like if it were barbecue, I would give it to Han Solo because yep. He's the type of guy who's like, cooking, fuck that. But I'm gonna put this tauntaun on a spit and it's gonna kick ass.
Yep.
So, but that's not the battle. It's bake off. I'm going to say Captain Kirk, because he, if anything else, seems to be able to pull out a solution from nowhere, even when you didn't think he could.
Yep.
So it's pretty clear cut. It's Captain Kirk.
I agree with you. I agree with you all, on the grounds that, first of all, the Enterprise is a very large vessel that travels, long distances. There's lots of time.
Yeah.
And it has pretty much any amenity that you could imagine.
Yeah.
Certainly any amenity that you could imagine being on a starship.
He can be like, computer, make me some popovers. And
even if he doesn't use the computer, I would say there's got to be, even though they can ask for food in that manner in the Star Trek universe to some degree, I gotta believe there is several kitchens on the Enterprise, and I gotta believe that Captain Kirk, being the good and thorough captain that he is, has familiarized himself with the kitchens.
I like that strain of thought.
And compared to that, the Millennium Falcon and Han Solo being a smuggler.
Yeah,
lives much more of a hot plate style existence. I think Han Solo spends a lot of time eating in whatever the Mos Eisley equivalent of a diner is.
Well, I bet he has his one dish, though.
Yeah, I bet he makes something really, really well.
Like he can make spiced lamb couscous. Like that's his thing when he wants to impress someone, which isn't often.
He makes a phenomenal risotto when he has the time. It's just he never has the time.
But this is baking. That's a difference.
That's true too.
We've already given him the barbecue title.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
Well, it's not about that.
Plus Chewbacca is always eating the dough before it's had a chance to rise.
Yeah. And the thing is he just sort of leans down. He can't get it on his hands or he'd be picking that out like all day long. He just ties his hair back and puts his face down in the dough ball. Okay, who in each of the universes would be the most bakerly? Like you'd be like, well, of course, I would say C-3PO.
Yeah,
he'd be like, I can bake in 9,000 cuisines.
Well, we already know that like Yoda's a shitty cook.
Yep.
Good food notwithstanding.
Yeah. He's a good baker as far as the Yodish people are concerned.
Could be. I'm going to say...
I'm sorry, what is Yoda? What kind of creature is Yoda?
I wish I could remember. I'm sure we're going to get overwhelmed with human Wikipedias on this. Of course, we could just look it up as soon as the podcast is done.
Yeah, you make your answer. I'll look it up.
Okay, I was going to make my answer that I think in the Star Trek universe, I am going to say either Guinan. These are both next generation, so I'm sort of cheating. But I would say either Guinan or Data would be the best cooks.
That well, no, not Cook. Baker.
Baker. Excuse me. My answer still stands.
I'm going with Data on Baker, because unlike cooking, where it's sort of like, I'm kind of feeling it out here. I'm gonna throw this in there. Baking is much more.
Baking is mathematical.
Yeah, it's precision, and yep. It's about humidity, and it's about air pressure and precision. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. But I would love to see Data and C-3PO have like a cooking show.
and they also at night ass. They solve crime.
Isn't that funny? We ended up with two droids. And hold on.
And we're both looking at Yoda's species.
Yeah, looking for Yoda.
Jedi Master Yoda is known as a venomous species whose true name is not recorded.
I call it bullshit. He's Yodish.
Known in some sources simply as Yoda's species.
Uh-huh. It wasn't a dumb question, was it?
Nope.
It's a gap.
You know what we're going to say? He's a dink.
All right, well, we have to task Bonnie Burton, our close personal friend Bonnie Burton of the Star Wars universe.
Yes.
To close that gap. Craft the Star Wars universe's way out of that dilemma.
Give us a species for Yoda, Bonnie. We're asking you now.
And wow, this is like one of our long cast severs.
Yeah, slightly long, 40-something minutes. I mean, we have been off for 2 weeks, so.
Yeah, we gotta not do that as much.
Yeah, I know. Well, we could give the people what they want, always leave them wanting more, whatever the hell that is.
Yeah, we're still not certain what we do, but
yeah, I'm but glad we're sure doing it. 105 shows later, we gotta have more guests too. Not every week or so, but I'm enjoying the guest dynamic.
I agree. It's fun, and it's I think when we do them, we should approach it as a semi interview. Yeah. So. It'll devolve into the same bullshittery as ever. So why not? I guess it depends on who we have.
I suppose that's true.
But you folks, let us know, who you want us to interview. I know we've asked this before, and of course we can't get anybody, but we can try.
We can try.
Where are we going to be?
Oh, good God. Where are we going to be? We're going to be at PAX.
Yeah, PAX East.
PAX East in the beginning of March in Boston. And now I have to point my light up at my calendar, as I always do. We have I'm not going to say any actual names yet, but we have a potential show in the Pacific Northwest in late March. It's not official yet, but it's damn close.
Yeah.
We're going to, in May, we have a number of balls in the air that have not landed hard enough to be able to announce anything until May. On the 6th, we're going to be at the Birchmere in our hometown, Arlington, Virginia. And then, or is the Birchmere in Alexandria? I always forget.
It's in Alexandria, but not by very much.
Yeah. And then on the Saturday, the 7th of May, we're at the Ram's Head Tavern in Annapolis.
Yeah. And and of course, go to paulandstorm.com. to learn how to become part of the Brigade of Minions. And you'll be in the running to be the penultimate minion. There have only been three of them so far. So,
that's
six.
Yes.
Or some very small number.
Some small number.
Larger
number, less than 10.
Less than 10, but more than pi.
Right.
And other than that, I'm Storm.
And I'm Paul.
And we've been talking about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes.
On average. Hodor!
Go do things.